Whenever I go to the dump, I always leave with a great sense of relief, and on this occasion decided to reward myself with a visit to the local garden centre on the way home. It was while I was walking happily between the rows of plants and shrubs, looking for something to buy, that it started to rain. A low, ragged rain cloud, looking like ink spreading in clear water, raced overhead, and the rain poured down, driving the shoppers indoors and leaving the garden centre suddenly deserted. I found myself standing alone among the green plants and shrubs. My mobile phone rang. It was Rob, the on-call registrar from the hospital. "I'm very sorry to disturb you," he said, going through the usual polite litany my juniors always recite whenever they call me, "but could I discuss a case with you, please?" "Yes, yes, of course," I said, hurrying off to find shelter in a warehouse full of terracotta pots. "This is a 34-year-old man who fell from a bridge." "A jumper?" "Yes, apparently he'd been depressed for some time." I asked if he had landed on his head or on his feet. "If they hit the ground feet first, they fracture their feet and spines and end up paralyzed, and if they hit their head first, they usually die." "He landed on his feet, but he hit his head as well," came the reply. "He's a polytrauma case. He's got a fractured pelvis, bilateral tib and fibs, and a severe head injury." "What does the scan show?" "A large hemorrhagic contusion in the left temporal lobe, and the basal cisterns are gone. He's had a big fixed pupil on the left for 5 hours now." "And his motor response?" "None, according to the ambulance men." "Well, what do you want to do?" Rob hesitated, reluctant to commit himself. "Well, I suppose we could pressure monitor him. What do you think is his prognosis?" "Not very good." I told Rob that it would be better to let him die. He would probably die whatever we did, and even if he did survive, he'd be left terribly disabled. I asked him if he had seen the family. "No, but they're coming in," he replied. "Well, spell it out to them," I said. While we were speaking, the rain had stopped and the sun had come out from behind the broken clouds. The plants around me glittered with reflected light. The shoppers emerged from the shelter of the shop, and the pastoral scene of the garden centre resumed. Happy gardeners walked between the rows of plants and trees, stopping to examine them and wondering which to buy. I bought myself a viburnum paniculata with little starbursts of white flowers and drove home with it, perched in a friendly sort of way, on the passenger seat beside me. I could have operated on this poor suicidal man and possibly saved his life, but at what cost? Or so I told myself, as I started to dig a hole in the back garden for the viburnum. Eventually, I felt forced to go into the hospital to look at the scan myself and to see the patient. Despite my best efforts, I found it difficult to deliver a death sentence, even on a jumper, on the basis of hearsay evidence alone. My shoes had become soaking wet in the downpour, and I changed them for a new pair, recently resoled, before driving into the hospital. I met Rob in the dark X-ray viewing room. He summoned up a brain scan on the computer screens. "Well," I said, as I looked at the CT scans, "he's wrecked." It was a relief that the scan looked even worse than Rob's description of it over the phone. The left side of the man's brain was smashed beyond repair, his brain darkened on the scan by edema and flecked with white, the colour of blood on CT brain scans. His brain was so swollen that there was no hope of survival, even in a disabled state, even if we operated. "There are two great benefits to medicine as a career," I said to Rob. "One is that one acquires an endless fund of anecdotes, some funny, many terrible." I told him about a jumper I had treated years ago, a pretty young woman in her 20s who jumped under a tube train. She had to have a hindquarter amputation of one leg. the leg removed completely at the level of the pelvis. I suppose the train had run lengthwise over her hip and leg. She'd also suffered a compound depressed skull fracture, which was why she was sent over to us after the local hospital had done the amputation. We sorted her head out, and she slowly woke up over the next few days. I remember telling her she'd lost her leg, and she said, "Oh dear, doesn't sound very nice, does it?" But she was quite happy at first. Obviously couldn't remember all the unhappiness that had made her throw herself under the train. But as she recovered from her head injury, as she got better, so to speak, she got worse, since her memories started to return, and every day you could see her become more and more depressed and desperate. When her parents eventually turned up, you could see why she had tried to kill herself. It was very sad to watch. "What happened to her?" Rob asked. "I haven't a clue. We sent her back to the local hospital, and I heard no more." "What is the second benefit of a career in medicine?" Rob asked politely. "Oh, just that if one falls ill oneself, one knows how to get the best care." I waved at the brain scan on the monitor in front of us. "I'll go and talk to his parents." I left the X-ray viewing area and walked along the dull and overlit hospital corridor to the ITU. The hospital was still very new. It felt like a high-security prison. Doors could only be opened with a swipe card, and if the doors were left open for more than a minute, an ear-splitting alarm would sound. Fortunately, since then, most of the alarms have broken or been sabotaged, but our first few months in the new building were spent with the almost constant sound of alarms going off. An odd phenomenon for a hospital full of sick people, one might think. I walked into the ITU. Lined around its walls were the forms of the unconscious patients, on ventilators surrounded by machinery, with a nurse at each bed. The nurses at the central desk pointed to one of the beds when I asked about the new admission, and I walked over to it. I was taken aback by the fact that the poor jumper was immensely fat. For some reason, I didn't expect a suicide to be fat, so fat that from the end of the bed I could not see his head at all, only the great pale mound of his naked belly, partly covered by a clean sheet, and beyond it the monitors and machinery and syringe drivers at the head of the bed, with their flashing red LEDs and digital readouts. An elderly man was sitting on a chair at the bedside and got up when he saw me. I introduced myself and we shook hands. "Are you his father?" I asked. "Yes," he said quietly. "I'm very sorry," I said, "but there's nothing we can do to help." I explained that his son would die within the next 24 hours. The old man said nothing other than to nod his head. There was little expression on his face. Whether he was too stunned or too estranged, I do not know. I never got to see his son's face, and I do not know what human tragedy lay behind the pathetic dying bulk that lay on the hospital bed beside us. I went home and climbed up the stairs to the attic room I had built the previous year, to where Kate was lying on a sofa, recovering from a particularly bad relapse of her Crohn's disease. I had made the staircase of oak myself, and had sanded and polished the steps to a high finish. We discussed the need for an extra handrail on the stairs, since Kate slipped on the stairs and bruised herself quite badly 2 nights earlier. We have both always been a little dismissive of the health and safety culture that increasingly dominates our risk-averse society, but decided that a handrail was probably a good idea. I set off downstairs, down the handmade oak stairs, each tread and riser carefully made by myself, to finish planting the viburnum in the back garden. My newly soled shoes slipped on the over-polished oak. I lost my balance, heard the horrible explosive crack of my leg breaking and my foot dislocating, and fell down the stairs. Although breaking one's leg is indeed very painful, it is surprisingly easy to tolerate. It is well known, after all, that soldiers in battle rarely feel great pain if they are seriously wounded. The pain comes later. You're too busy working out how to save yourself to think much about the pain.
Bloody hell! I've broken my leg!
I shouted. Kate, at first, thought I was joking, until she found me at the bottom of the stairs, with my left foot twisted round at an improbable angle. I tried